immortal god like this for the sake of mortal men. At the word, Hephaestus quenched his furious fires, and the river ran down between his banks as before. So Hera stayed that quarrel when Xanthus was pacified, although she was still angry, but the other gods were bitter against each other on the opposing sides. They soon fell to it with a great din, until the wide earth rang again and the high heavens trumpeted. Zeus heard the noise, sitting on Mount Ida. His heart laughed with glee to see god meeting god in battle. Shield-piercing Ares began, with a leap at Athena, spear in hand, shouting insults as he came. "Why do you pit gods against gods again, you dog-fly, with that bold audacity of yours, that furious temper? Don't you remember how you let loose Diomedes, Tydides, to wound me? How you caught that spear in the sight of all and sent it straight at me and tore my beautiful flesh? You will pay now for what you did then, I think." With this threat, he lunged his spear against the tasseled Aegis cape, that terrible cape which is proof against the thunderbolt of Zeus. Athena stepped back and picked up a great stone that stood in the ground, black and rough, an ancient landmark, and threw it and hit Ares on the neck. He collapsed and fell in his rattling armor, dabbing his hair in the dust. 7 roods of land his great body covered. Pallas Athena triumphant told him her mind in plain words. "You silly fool, do you think yourself a match for me? You have not found out yet how much stronger I am than you. That may satisfy your mother's curses for deserting the Achaeans and taking the Trojan side. She is angry, I can tell you." So saying, she turned her eyes away. Aphrodite caught him by the hand and helped him up, groaning heavily and still half-dazed. But Hera saw this and called out to Athena, "Look at that, Atrytone! Look, you daughter of Almighty Zeus, here's this dog-fly again leading the pest of all mankind out of the battle. After her!" Athena was after her with joy, rushed at her and gave her a push on the breast with her open hand, which brought them both down in a heap. Then she told the pair what she thought of them. "I wish all those who helped the Trojans were like these when they meet the Achaeans in battle, as bold and as hearty as Aphrodite when she confronted me to help her Ares. Then we should long ago have made an end of this war, and we should have sacked the tall fortress of Troy." Hera smiled. My lord Earthshaker was facing Apollo, and he spoke next.
"Phoebus, why are we too out of it? The others have begun, and we ought to do something. It would be a disgrace to return to that brazen house on Olympus without a battle. You begin. You are the younger, and it would hardly be fair for an older god of more experience like me." "You silly fool. There is not much sense in your head. Do you forget what we two had to suffer at Ilios all by ourselves when Zeus sent us to serve Laomedon for 1 year at a fixed wage, when he was master and gave us orders? My job was to build a fine broad wall round the city to make it invincible. Yours, Phoebus, was to tend the cattle on the foothills of Ida. But when payday came, happy day, that terrible man robbed us of all our pay. Told us to go, threatened to tie us up, hand and foot, and sell us somewhere along the islands, far away. Said he would lop off both our ears. So we came back, disappointed, without our pay. He promised, you see, and did not pay up. That's the man whose people you are obliging so kindly. Instead of joining us and doing your best to destroy them, out and out, women and children and all."
Apollo answered, "Look here, Earthshaker, you could not call me a sane god if I were really to fight you for the sake of mortal men. Poor things, they are like the leaves of the forest, you know, grow up full of fire and eat the kindly fruits of the earth, then wither away and perish. Come along, let the others fight, and we will keep out of it." So he turned away, for he felt shy of coming to blows with his own father's brother. But his sister, the wild beasts lady, Artemis Huntress, scolded him roundly in no flattering words. "So,
You run away, Shutafar. You let Poseidon have all the honors and give him victory for nothing? Silly fool, what is your bow for? A wind bow, useless. Don't let me hear you boasting again in our father's hall before all the family how you will stand up to Poseidon and fight him.
Apollo made no answer to this.
But Hera did, and she scolded the archeress roundly.
How can you dare to put yourself against me, you bold bitch? You will find it hard to face my wrath in spite of the bow you carry, for women are your prey. Zeus has made you a lion among the women, and let you kill any you like. You had better go and show your prowess in the mountains by killing savage beasts and wild deer, and leave your betters alone. But if you want to learn the art of war, I'll show you I am the stronger when you set up yourself against me. She grasped both the other's wrists in her own left hand, and with her right pulled the quiver off her shoulders and beat it about her ears, smiling at her twists and wriggles, while the arrows fell out in a shower. Artemis was in tears by this time, and she managed to slip away underneath. She was off like a dove chased by a falcon into a cleft of the rocks, where she escaped for once by good fortune. So Artemis escaped, weeping, and left the arrows on the ground. Hermes said to his antagonist, "I won't fight with you, Leto. It's dangerous to bandy fisticuffs with the wives of Zeus, cloud-gatherer. You are heartily welcome to boast before the whole family that you beat me by force of arms." Leto just picked up her daughter's arrows, lying about in the dust, higgledy-piggledy, and went away. Artemis, however, got as far as the great hall of Zeus, and threw herself on her father's knees, weeping, while her soft robe quivered and shook. Her father clasped her close to him and asked, laughing gently, "My dear child, who in the heavens has treated you like this?" She answered,
"Your own wife slapped me, father, with her pretty white hands. Your wife, Hera, who began all this quarreling and fighting in our family."
While all this was going on, Phoebus Apollo entered the city of Ilios. He was anxious about the place and feared the Danians might take it that very day before its time. The other gods had gone home, some resentful, some triumphant, to their places beside their father, the Thundercloud. But Achilles was dealing death on men and horses alike, carrying with him devastation and woe, as when smoke rises to heaven over a burning city after the wrath of God has brought upon it devastation and woe. But old King Priam was standing on the wall when he suddenly saw Achilles, like some monstrous portent, sweeping the Trojans before him in rout, and there was no help. Groaning aloud, he came down from the wall and called to the keepers of the gate as he went along, "Open the gates wide and hold them in hand until our people come in. They are flying before Achilles, and here he is close at hand, driving them on. I think this will be a bad business. But as soon as they are all safe inside, close the gates fast at once, for I fear that man of destruction may make a dash to get in too." They ran back the bolts and pushed back the gates, now the one hope of safety, and Apollo leapt out to meet them, that he might save the Trojans from destruction. Straight to the lofty walls they ran, parched with thirst, smothered in dust. Close behind Achilles plied his spear, his heart possessed with madness and the lust of victory. Then the Achaeans would have taken Troy, but for Phoebus Apollo. There was a brave man there, Agenor, the stalwart son of Antenor, and Apollo strengthened his heart with courage, and himself stood by him, leaning against the oak, but hidden in mist, to keep from him the heavy hands of death. This man, when he saw Achilles coming, stood still in great perplexity of mind, and deeply moved, he said to his own brave heart, "Here is trouble for me. If I run before Achilles along with this terrified crowd, he will catch me all the same and cut my coward's throat. If I let the crowd go on in their rout before Achilles, and use my feet to escape somewhere else in the plain, I may get into the foothills of Ida and hide under the bushes. Then I may cool off my sweat in the river and come back to Ilios in the evening. But what's the use of thinking such things? Suppose he notices me taking myself off towards the plain, runs after me and catches me with those quick feet of his.
Then there will be no escape from death, for he is stronger than any man alive.
Then what if I stand up to him where I am?
The man's flesh can be cut, I suppose. He has no more than one life. They say he's mortal, and Zeus Cronides gives the victory. With these thoughts he pulled himself together to await Achilles, firmly resolved to fight for it. He was like some panther in the thick bush before the huntsman, which fears not and flees not when she hears the baying of the hounds. Even if the man gets in first with a stab or a shot, though pierced with a spear, she loses no courage until she grapple or die. So this man, Agenor, the brave son of a doughty sire, would not think of flight before he could try Achilles. He held the shield ready before him and shouted aloud, "I suppose you hope, Achilles, this day to take the city of Troy. Silly fool! Much pain yet remains to be suffered for Troy. There are many men within and strong men, and we stand before our wives and children to defend our fortress. You shall meet your fate here, terrible and bold though you are." Then he aimed the spear and let fly. The blade struck just under the knee with a loud clang, but it glanced off the tin of the shin guard without piercing the god's masterpiece. Achilles was following up when Apollo carried off the man in a mist and sent him in peace out of the battle. Then he kept Achilles away from the battlefield by a trick. Achilles saw Agenor, as he thought, standing before his feet, and rushed after him, chased him over the plain, turned him towards the river Scamandros, always just a little behind. For that was Apollo's trick, so that Achilles always expected to catch him at the next step. Meanwhile, the mob of routed Trojans managed to get behind the walls until the place was full of them, and glad they were to get there. They had not spirit left in them to wait for one another and see who was dead and who was alive. They simply poured into the city, all whose legs were quick enough to save them. Book 22 of The Last Fight and the Death of Hector. Now the routed men were huddled together in the city like a lot of trembling fawns. And while they cooled off their sweat and drank to assuage their thirst, leaning upon the battlements, the Achaeans came near to the walls and formed up with their shields against their shoulders. But Hector stayed where he was, in front of the Scaean gates, for the shackles of fate held him fast. Then Apollo made himself known to the pursuing Achilles. "Why are you chasing me, Pelides?" he said. "Mortal man chasing immortal god. You never knew that I was a god, I see. You are still as wild as ever. You routed the Trojans, and now you care nothing about them. Just look, they are all collected in the city, and you have wandered away here. You will not kill me, for death cannot come near me." Achilles answered angrily, "You have baffled me, shoot afar. Cruel god, to draw me here away from the walls. Many more should have bit the dust before I reached Ilios. Now you have saved their lives and robbed me of my victory. Easy enough, since you have no vengeance to fear. I would certainly have my revenge if I had the power." Then he was gone in his angry pride, like a prize racehorse with a car behind him that gallops over the plain, straining every muscle. The old King Priam was the first to see him speeding over the plain. His armor shone on his breast, like the star of harvest whose rays are most bright among many stars in the murky night. They call it Orion's dog. Most brilliant is that star, but he is a sign of trouble and brings many fevers for unhappy mankind. The old man groaned, and lifting up his hands, beat them upon his head as he groaned, and cried aloud to his son, entreating him. But his son was standing before the gates, immovable, and determined to meet Achilles face to face. "Oh, Hector," the old man cried in piteous tones as he stretched out his hands, "Hector, my beloved son, do not face that man alone, without a friend, or fate will soon find you out. Do not be so hard-hearted. Peleon will destroy you, for he is stronger than you are.
Oh, that the gods loved him as I do! Soon would vultures and dogs feast on him lying on the ground. Then this cruel pain would pass from my heart. He has bereaved me of many sons and good sons, killing and selling to far-off islands. Now again there are two sons that I cannot see amongst those who are crowded here in the city, Lycaon and Polydorus. Their mother was the princess Leothewe. If they are alive in the enemy camp, they shall be ransomed. There is gold and bronze enough here, for she had plenty from her old father Altes. If they are dead already, and in the house of Hades, there is grief for their mother and for me, their father. But for the rest of the people, the grief will not last so long, if only you do not die with them by the hands of Achilles. Do come within these walls, my son. Save the men and women of our city. Life is sweet. Do not let Achilles rob you of life and win glory for himself. Pity me also, an old man, but not too old to know, not too old to be unhappy. A miserable portion indeed Father Cronides will give me, then, to perish in my old age, after I have lived to see many troubles, seen my sons destroyed and my daughters dragged into slavery. My house ransacked, little children dashed on the ground in fury, my sons' wives dragged away by Achaean hands, and myself last of all. Someone shall strike me down or pierce my body and leave me dead at my door for carrion dogs to devour. My own table dogs, my watch dogs, which I have fed with my own hands, will go mad and lap my blood and lie sated by the door where they used to watch. For a young man, all is decent when he is killed in battle. He may be mangled with wounds. All is honorable in his death, whatever may come. But a hoary head and a white beard, and nakedness violated by dogs when an old man is killed, there is the most pitiable sight that mortal eyes can see. As the old man spoke, he tore the white hairs from his head. But Hector would not listen. His mother stood there also, weeping. She loosened the folds of her dress, and with the other hand bared her breast, and through her tears cried out the secrets of her heart. "Oh, Hector, my own child, by this I beseech you, have pity on me, if ever I gave you the soothing breast. Remember this, my love, and come behind these walls. Let these walls keep off that terrible man. Do not stand out in front against him. Do not be so hard. For if he kill you, never shall I lay you on your bier. Never shall I mourn over you, my pretty bud, son of my own body, nor your precious wife. We shall both be far away, and Danian dogs will devour you in the Danian camp." But their tears and their prayers availed nothing with Hector's proud spirit. He stood fast and awaited the coming of his tremendous foe. Like a serpent of the mountains over his hole, fed full of poisons and imbued with bitter hate, who lies in wait, coiled about the hole and fiercely glaring, so Hector, imbued with unquenchable passion, would not retreat, but stood leaning his shield against a bastion of the wall. Then, deeply moved, he spoke to his own heart. "What shall I do? If I retreat behind these walls, Polydamas will be the first to heap reproaches on me, for he advised me to lead the army back to the city on that dread night when Achilles rose up. I would not listen. It would have been better if I had. And now that I have ruined them all by my rashness, I am ashamed to face the men and women of Troy. Or some base fellows may say, 'Hector thought too much of his own strength and ruined us all.' They will say that, and my better part is to face him for life and death. Either I shall kill him and return in triumph, or I shall die with honor before the gate. Shall I lay down my shield and helmet and lean my spear against the wall and go to meet him alone and promise to yield Helen with all her wealth, all that Alexandros brought with her to Troy? Yield the woman who was the cause of the great war. Let the princes of Argos take her away. Offer to pay besides half the treasure of our city. Make the elders of the city take oath to hide nothing, but to divide honestly all we possess. But what good would that be?
Suppose I should approach him, and then he would have pity and would not spare me. Suppose I should strip off my armor, and then he should just kill me, naked like a woman. This is no place for fairy tales or lovers' pretty prattle, the way of a man with a maid when a man and maid prattle so prettily together. Better get to work at once. We'll see which of us the Olympian makes the winner. So he mused and stood his ground, while Achilles drew near, like Enyalios, the warrior god, shaking over his right shoulder that terrible Pelian ash plant. The armor upon him shone like flaming fire or beams of the rising sun. Hector trembled to see him. He could stand no longer, but took to flight, and Pelides was upon him with a leap. Hector fled swiftly under the walls of Troy, and Pelides flew after him furiously, as a falcon swoops without effort after a timid dove, for he is the swiftest of flying things, and he darts upon her with shrieking cries close behind, greedy for a kill. They passed the lookout and the wind-beaten fig tree, keeping ever away from the wall along the cart road, until they reached the two fountains which are the sources of eddying Scamandros. One is a spring of hot water with steam rising above it as if it were boiling over a fire. One, even in summer, is cold as hail or snow or frozen ice. Near these are the tanks of stone where the Trojan women and girls used to wash their linen in peacetime before the Achaeans came. So far they came in their race, fleeing and pursuing, a strong man fleeing, and a far stronger in pursuit. They ran hard, for Hector's life was the prize of this race, not such prizes as men run for, a beast or an ox-hide shield. Thrice round the city of Priam they ran, like champion racehorses running round the turning post for a tripod or a woman or some great stake, when a man is dead and the games are given in his honor. All the gods were watching, and the father of gods and men exclaimed, "Confound it, I love that man whom I see hunted round those walls. I am deeply grieved for Hector, who has sacrificed many an ox on the heights of Ida or the citadel of Troy. And now there is Prince Achilles chasing him round the city of Priam. What do you think, gods? Just consider, shall we save him from death, or shall we let Achilles beat him now? He is a brave man." Athena, bright eyes, replied, "Oh, father, flashing bolt, oh, thundercloud, you must never say that. A mortal man, long doomed by fate, and you will save him from death? Do as you please, but the rest of us cannot approve." Zeus, cloud-gatherer, answered, "Never mind, Tritogenea, my love, I did not really mean it, and I want to be kind to you. Wait no longer, but do what you wish." Athena was ready enough, and shot away down the slopes of Olympus. Achilles was now following at full speed, and gave Hector no chance. He watched him like a hound which has put up a hart from his lair and gives chase through the dingles and the dells. Let the hart hide and crouch in the brake, the hound tracks him out till he finds. If Hector, going by the road, made a dash at the city gates for refuge, hoping his friends might help him with a volley from the walls above, Achilles would take a short cut and get before him, running under the walls and turning him back towards the open ground. It was like some race in a dream, where one chases another and he cannot catch, nor the other escape. So Achilles could never catch Hector, or Hector escape Achilles. How indeed could Hector have escaped his fleet pursuer so far, if Apollo had not then, for the last time, been near to give him strength and speed? And Achilles had signaled to his own men that no one should let fly a shot at Hector, and take his own credit away if he came in second. But when the fourth time they drew near the two fountains, see now, the father laid out his golden scales and placed in them two fates of death, one for Achilles and one for Hector. He grasped the balance and lifted it. Hector's doom sank down to Hades, and Apollo left him.
At that moment Athena was by the side of Achilles, and she said in plain words, "Now you and I will win, my splendid Achilles. Now I hope we shall bring great glory to our camp before the Achaean nation by destroying Hector for all his insatiable courage. Now there is no chance that he can escape, not if Apollo Shudafar should fume and fret and roll over and over on the ground before Zeus Almighty. Rest and take breath, and I will go and persuade the man to stand up to you." Achilles was glad of a rest and stood still, leaning on his barbed ash plant. Athena now took the form and voice of Deiphobus. She went over to Hector and said to him simply, "Achilles is giving you a hard time, old fellow, chasing you like this round the city. Let us stand and defend ourselves." Hector answered, "Oh, Deiphobus, I always liked you best of all the sons of my father and mother. But now I shall think more of you than ever for daring to come outside for my sake when you saw me here. All the rest keep inside." Athena said, "My dear old fellow, father and mother and all our friends begged and besought me to stay. They are so terribly afraid of him, but I had not the heart to desert you. Now then, let us have at him. No sparing of spears. Let us see whether he will kill us both and carry off our blood-stained spoils, or if your spear shall bring him down." So the deceiver led him towards Achilles. And when they were near him, Hector spoke, "I will fly from you no more, Pelides. 3 times I raced round the city of Priam, and would not await your attack. But now my heart bids me stand and face you, for death or for life. But first come near, and let us give our troth. The gods shall be the best witnesses and sentinels of our agreement. If Zeus gives me endurance, and if I take your life, I will do no vile outrage to your body. I will take your armor, Achilles, and your body I will give back to your people. You do the same." Achilles answered with a frowning face, "Hector, I cannot forget. Talk not to me of bargains. Lions and men make no truce. Wolves and lambs have no friendship. They hate each other forever. So there can be no love between you and me, and there shall be no truce for us until one of the two shall fall and glut Ares with his blood. Call up all your manhood. Now you surely need to be a spearman and a bold man of war. There is no chance of escape now. This moment Pallas Athena shall bring you low by my spear. Now in one lump sum you shall pay for all my companions whom you have slain and I have mourned." With the words he poised and cast his long spear, but Hector saw it coming and crouched down so that it flew over and stuck in the earth. Pallas Athena pulled it out and gave it back to Achilles, but Hector saw nothing. Then Hector said, "Amiss! I am not dead yet, as you thought, most magnificent Achilles. So there was something Zeus did not tell you about me, as it seems. You are only a rattle-tongue with a trick of words, trying to frighten me and make me lose heart. I am not going to run and let you pierce my back. I will charge you straight, and then you may strike me in the breast, if it be God's will. But first, see if you avoid my spear. I pray that you may take it all into your body. The war will be lighter for Troy if you are dead, for you are our greatest danger." He poised his spear and cast it, and hit the shield fair in the middle. But the spear rebounded and fell away. Hector was troubled that the cast had failed. He had no second spear, and he stood discomfited. Then he shouted to Deiphobus and called for another. But no Deiphobus was there. Now Hector knew the truth, and cried out, "All is lost. It is true, then, the gods have summoned me to death. Deiphobus was by my side, I thought. But he is in the city, and I have been deceived by Athena. Now then, death is near me. There can be no delay. There is no escape. All this while such must have been the pleasure of Zeus and his son Shudafar, who have kindly protected me so far. But now fate is upon me. Yet I pray that I may die not without a blow, not inglorious. First may I do some notable thing that shall be remembered in generations to come. With these words he drew the sword that hung by his side, sharp and strong, gathered himself, and sprang like an eagle flying high and swooping down from the clouds upon a lamb or cowering hare. Achilles moved to meet him, full of fury, covering his chest with the resplendent shield, while the thick golden plumes nodded upon his flashing helmet. His right hand held poised the great spear, which gleamed like the finest of all the stars of heaven, the star of evening, brilliant in the dark night. He scanned Hector with ruthless heart to see where the white flesh gave the best opening for a blow. Hector was well covered with that splendid armor which he had stripped from Patroclus, but an opening showed where the collarbones joined the neck to the shoulder, the gullet where a blow brings quickest death. There Achilles aimed, and the point went through the soft neck, but it did not cut the windpipe, and Hector could still answer his foe. He fell in the dust, and Achilles cried in triumph, "There, Hector! You thought no doubt while you were stripping Patroclus that you would be safe. You cared nothing for me far away. Fool! There was an avenger, a stronger man than Patroclus, waiting far away. I was there, behind in the camp, and I have brought you low. Now you shall be mauled by vultures and dogs, and he shall be buried by a mourning nation." Hector, half-fainting, answered, "I beseech you by your soul and by your knees, by your father and your mother, do not leave me for dogs to mangle among your ships. Accept a ransom. My father and my mother will provide gold and treasure enough, and let them carry home my body, that my people may give me the fire which is the rightful due of the dead." Achilles said with an angry, frowning face, "Knee me no knees, you cur, and father me no fathers. No man living shall keep the dogs from your head, not if they bring ransom 10 times and 20 times innumerable, and weigh it out and promise more. Not if Priamos Dardanides pay your weight in gold. Not for that ransom shall your mother lay you out on the bier and mourn for the son of her womb. But carrion dogs and carrion birds shall devour you up. For what you have done to me, I wish from the bottom of my heart that I could cut you to pieces and eat you raw myself." Hector answered him, dying, "Ah, I know you well, and I forebode what will be. I was not likely to persuade you, for your heart is made of iron. But reflect, or I may bring God's wrath upon you on that day when Paris and Phoebus Apollo shall slay you by the Scaean gates, although you are strong." As he spoke, the shadow of death encompassed him, and his soul left the body and went down to Hades, bewailing his fate, bidding a last farewell to manhood and lusty strength. Hector was dead. But even so, Achilles again spoke, "Lie there, dead. My fate I will accept, whenever it is the will of Zeus and all gods to fulfill it." He drew the spear out of the body and laid it aside. Then he stripped off the armor, and the other Achaeans came crowding round. How they gazed in wonder at Hector's noble form and looks! Yet no one came near without a stab. They beat him and stabbed him, saying to each other, "Ha-ha! Hector feels very much softer now than when he burnt our ships with his blazing brands." Achilles, when he finished stripping the spoils, turned to the crowd and made them a speech in his downright manner. "My friends," he said, "princes and captains of the nation, since, as you see, the gods have granted me to kill this man who has done us more damage than all the rest put together, let us go round the city ready for battle and find out what they mean to do, whether they will leave their fortress now this man is dead, or whether they will still confront us, although they have no Hector." "But stay, what am I thinking about? Patroclus lies beside our ship unmourned, unburied. Patroclus, I can never forget, so long as I live and move. And even if in the house of Hades men forget their dead, yet I will remember my dear comrade even there. Come on, my lads, let us march back to our ship, singing our hymn of victory, and bring this man with us. We have won a great triumph. We have killed Hector, to whom the Trojans prayed as if he were a god. And then he thought of a shameful outrage. He cut behind the sinews of both Hector's feet from ankle to heel, and strapped them together with leather thongs, and fastened them to his chariot, leaving the head to drag. Then he laid the armor in the car and got in himself, and whipped up the horses. Away they flew, the dust rose. As the body was dragged along, the dark hair spread abroad. There, in the dirt, trailed the head that was once so charming, which now Zeus gave to his enemies to maltreat in his own native land. And as the head was bedabbled thus in the mire, his mother tore her hair and threw away the covering veil, and wailed aloud seeing her son. His father lamented sore, the people wailed, and lamentation filled the city. Such lamentation there might have been if all frowning Ilios were smoldering in ashes. The people had much ado to keep the old king in his frenzy from rushing out of the Dardanian gates. He rolled in the dung heap and appealed to all, naming each by his name. "Have done, my friends. I know you love me, but let me go out alone and visit the Achaean camp. Let me pray to this terrible, violent man. He may have shame before his fellows and pity an old man. Yes, I think he has an old father like me, Peleus, who begat him and bred him to be the ruin of Troy. And for me, more than all, he has brought trouble. So many of my sons he has killed in their prime. I mourn for them, but not for them all, so much as one who will bring me down with sorrow to the grave. My Hector! Would that he had died in my arms. Then we could have mourned and wept till we could weep no more, the unhappy mother who bore him, and I, his father." As he spoke, he wept, and the people lamented with him. Then Hecabe led the women's lamentation, herself weeping the while. "My child, I am desolate. How shall I live in sorrow when you are dead? Night and day you were my boast in the city, and a blessing to all, both men and women, who used to welcome you as one divine. Truly you were a great glory to them also while you lived. But now death and fate has come upon you." But Hector's wife had not yet heard anything of her husband. No messenger had told her the truth, that he remained outside the gate. She was busy with a loom in a far corner of the house, embroidering pretty flowers on a wide purple web. She called to the servants to put a cauldron to boil on the fire, that Hector might have a warm bath when he came in from the battle. Poor creature! She knew not that he was far away from all baths, brought low by the hands of Achilles and the will of bright-eyes Athena. But when she heard lamentation and wailing from the wall, her limbs quivered, and the shuttle fell to the ground out of her hand, and she called to her maids, "Here, come with me, two of you, and let me see what has happened. That was the voice of my honored good mother. My heart is in my mouth, my knees are turned to stone. Some trouble is at hand for the sons of Priam. Far from my ear be that word, but I am terribly afraid Prince Achilles has cut off my rash Hector by himself and driven him away to the plain. Ah, he will put an end to the fatal pride that always possessed him, for Hector would never stay in the crowd. He would always run out in front and yield in courage to no man." She tore out like a madwoman with beating heart, and the maids followed. When she came to the crowd of men on the battlements, she stood peering about. Then she saw him, dragged along in front of the city. The horses were dragging him at full speed toward the Achaean camp, careless what they did. Then the darkness of night came over her eyes, and she fell backwards, fainting and gasping. The coverings fell from her head, diadem, coif, braided circlet, and the veil which golden Aphrodite had given her on the day when Hector paid his rich bride gifts and led her away from Eetion's house. Crowded round her were Hector's sisters and good sisters, holding her up, distracted unto death.
When she came to herself and revived, she cried out amid her sobs, "Oh, Hector, I am unhappy.
So we were both born to one fate, you in Troy in the palace of Priam, I in Thebe under woody Placos in the house of Eetion, who brought me up as a tiny tot. Doomed, father, doomed, child. Would I had never been born. Now you have gone to the house of Hades deep down under the earth. But I am left in bitter grief, a widow in our home, and our son is still only a baby. Oh, doomed father, doomed mother, never will you be a blessing to him, Hector, or he to you, for you are dead. Even if he escapes from this miserable war, yet his portion shall be always labor and sorrow, for strangers will rob him of his lands. The day of orphanhood makes a child wholly friendless. He must always hang his head, his cheeks are slobbered with tears. He goes begging to his father's friends, and plucks one by the cloak, another by the shirt. If one has pity, he puts a cup to his mouth for a sip, wets the lips, but not the palate. The boy who has both father and mother slaps him and drives him away from the table with unkind words. Just get out, your father does not dine with us. Then the boy runs, crying to his widowed mother. Yes, Astyanax, who once sat on his own father's knee and ate only marrow and richest fat of sheep, and when he felt sleepy and did not want to play any more, he slept on the bedstead with nurse's arms around him, with a soft bed under him, full and satisfied. But now he will have plenty to suffer since his father is gone. My Astyanax, as they all call him in this city, because you alone saved their gates and walls. And now you are in the enemy camp, far from your father and mother. And when the dogs have had enough, crawling worms will eat your body. Naked, although there is nice soft linen in your house, made by your own women. But I will make a bonfire of the whole store. It is of no use to you, for your body will not lie out in that, but it will do you honor in the eyes of the people of Troy. She wept while she spoke, and the women lamented with her.
Book 23. The Funeral Rites of Patroclus, and How the Games Were Held in His Honor. While the Trojans were mourning within their city, the Achaeans made their way to the ships beside the Hellespont. Most of them dispersed to their own vessels, but Achilles would not let the Myrmidons disperse until he had addressed them in these words. "Your horses have done good service today, my brave comrades, but we must not unyoke them yet. Let us go, horses and chariots and all, to mourn for Patroclus, for that is the honor due to the dead. When we have consoled ourselves with lamentation, let us unharness them and take our meal." Then he led the cavalcade 3 times round the body, all mourning and crying aloud, and Thetis lamented with them. The sands were drenched with their tears, their armor was drenched, so much their hearts longed for that mighty man. And Pelides led their lamentations, as he laid his manslaying hands on his true friend's breast. "Fare thee well, Patroclus, even in the house of death. See, now, I am fulfilling all that I promised. I said I would drag Hector to this place and give him to the dogs to devour raw, and in front of your pyre I would cut the throats of 12 noble sons of the Trojans in payment for your death." Then he did a vile outrage to royal Hector. He stretched the body on its face in the dirt beside the bier of Menetiades. After that all took off their armor and unharnessed the loud whinnying horses and sat down beside the ship of Achilles in their thousands. There he provided a fine funeral feast. Many bellowing bulls fell under the knife, many sheep and bleating goats, many tusker boars, bursting with fat, were stretched out to singe over the fire. Around the dead body the blood of the victims, poured out in cupfuls, was running all over the ground. Meanwhile, Prince Pelion was being led by the Achaean chieftains to Agamemnon.
They had trouble to persuade him, so deep was his sorrow for his comrade. At the king's headquarters, orders were given to set a cauldron of water over the fire that his body might be washed clean of the bloodstains. But he flatly refused and swore to it, "No, by Zeus, highest and greatest of gods, it is not lawful that water may come near my head before I lay Patroclus on the fire and build him a barrow and cut off my hair. For no second sorrow like this shall come upon me so long as I am among the living. Yet for this present we must consent to the meal which we hate. Then tomorrow, my lord King Agamemnon, shall be for bringing firewood and providing all that is proper to send the dead down into the dark. The fire shall burn him quickly out of sight, and the people shall return to their work." They did accordingly. The meal was prepared, and all partook, and found no lack. When they were satisfied, the others retired to rest. But Pelides lay with many of his myrmidons, in the open air on the shore of the sounding sea, while the waves washed on the beach, lay groaning heavily until sleep fell upon him. A deep, sweet sleep that soothed the sorrows of his heart, for his strong limbs were weary with that long pursuit after Hector about the city of Ilios. In sleep came to him the soul of unhappy Patroclus, his very image in stature, and wearing clothes like his, with his voice and those lovely eyes. The vision stood by his head and spoke. "You sleep, Achilles, and you have forgotten me. When I lived, you were not careless of me, but now that I am dead, bury me without delay that I may pass the gates of Hades. Those phantoms hold me off, the souls of those whose work is done. They will not suffer me to join them beyond the river, but I wander aimlessly about the broad gates of the house of Hades. And give me that hand, I pray, for never again shall I come back from Hades when once you have given me my portion of fire. Never again in life shall we go apart from our companions and take counsel together. But I am swallowed up already by that cruel fate which got me on the day I was born. And you also have your portion, my magnificent Achilles, to perish before the walls of this great city. One thing more, I say, and I will put it upon you as a charge if you will comply. Do not lay my bones apart from yours, Achilles, but with them, as I was brought up with you in your home, when Menoetius brought me quite a little one from Opoeus to your house, from manslaughter the day I killed Amphidamas' son. I did not mean it. We had a silly quarrel over the knuckle-bones. Then Peleus received me and brought me up kindly in his house and named me as your attendant. Then let one urn cover my bones with yours, that golden two-handled urn which your gracious mother gave you." Achilles said in answer, "Why have you come here, beloved one, with all these charges of this and that? Of course I will do as you tell me, every bit. But come nearer. For one short moment let us lay our arms about each other and console ourselves with lamentation." He stretched out his arms as he spoke, but he could not touch, for the soul was gone like smoke into the earth twittering. Achilles leapt up in amazement and clapped his hands with solemn words. "See there, now. So there is still something in the house of Hades, a soul and a phantom, but no real life in it at all. For all night long the soul of unhappy Patroclus has been by my side, sorrowing and lamenting and telling me what to do, and it was mightily like himself." All around were moved to lamentation when they heard his words. They were still mourning when dawn showed her fingers of light. Then King Agamemnon sent out mules and men from the whole camp to bring firewood, under the charge of Idomeneus' man Meriones. The company set out with their axes and ropes, driving the mules in front, a long journey, up along, down along, off along, and criss-cross. On the foothills of Mount Ida they felled the tall trees busily. Down came the trees with a crash. The men split them and tied them on the mules. The mules tore up the earth, hurrying to the flat land, scrambling through the bushes and over the plain. All the woodcutters had logs to carry, under the orders of Meriones. Down on the shore they laid their logs in order, in the place where Achilles designed a great barrel for Patroclus and himself. When the logs were laid in their places, the men sat where they were, all together. Then Achilles ordered his myrmidons to don their armor and harness their horses. They mounted the cars, both fighting men and drivers, chariots in front, a cloud of footmen behind, thousands. And in the midst was Patroclus, borne by his comrades. They had cut off their hair and thrown it over the body like a shroud. Achilles came behind him, clasping the head. His own unspotted comrade he was escorting to the grave. At the place which Achilles had appointed, they laid him down and piled great heaps of firewood. Then Achilles did his part. He stood away from the pile and cut off the golden tress which he had kept uncut among his thick hair for the river Spercheios, and spoke deeply moved as he gazed over the dark sea. "Oh, Spercheios, this is not for thee. That vow was vain which Peleus my father made, that when I return to my native land I would consecrate my hair to thee and make solemn sacrifice, and that he would sacrifice 50 rams without blemish into thy waters at the altar which is in thy precinct at the same place. That was my father's vow, but thou didst not fulfill his hope. Now, therefore, since I am not to return to my native land, I would give the warrior Patroclus this to carry with him." Then he laid the hair in the hands of his well-loved companion. All present broke into lamentation with all their hearts, and they would not have ceased while the sun shone, but Achilles drew near to Agamemnon and said to him, "Atrides, you are our lord paramount, and it is yours to command. There is plenty of time for the people to mourn, but just now I ask you to dismiss them from this place and tell them to get ready their meal. All this is the business of those who are nearest akin to the dead, and let the chieftains remain with us." Agamemnon accordingly dismissed the people while the mourners remained, and piled up the wood and made a pyre of 100 feet each way, and upon it they laid the body. They killed flocks of sheep and herds of cattle in front of the pyre, skinned them and cut them up. Achilles took away all the fat and covered the dead with it from head to foot, and heaped the flayed bodies about him. Jars of honey and oil he placed leaning against the bier. 4 horses he laid carefully on the pyre, groaning aloud. 9 dogs the prince had that fed from his table. 2 of these Achilles took and cut their throats and laid beside him. 12 noble young Trojans he slew without mercy. Then he applied the relentless fire to consume all. And with a groan he called on his comrade's name. "Fare thee well, Patroclus, even in the grave, fare thee well. See, I now fulfill all that I promised you before. Here are the 12 noble sons of Trojans. The fire is eating them round about you. Hector Priamides, the fire shall not have to eat, but the dogs." But his threat was vain. No dogs were busy about Hector, for the dogs were driven off by the daughter of Zeus, Aphrodite herself, by day and by night. She washed the skin with rose oil of ambrosia, that it might not be torn by the dragging, and Phoebus Apollo drew down a dark cloud from heaven to earth, and covered the place where the body lay, that the sun might not scorch the flesh too soon over the sinews of his limbs. But the pyre would not burn, and Achilles did not know what to do. At last he stood well away from the smouldering heap and prayed to North Wind and West Wind, promising them good sacrifices. Many a libation he poured from his golden goblet, praying them to come and make the wood quickly catch fire to burn the bodies. Iris heard his prayers and flew quickly to the winds with their message. They were all in a party at West Wind's, and having a fine feast, when in came Iris flying, and stood on the doorstone. As soon as they set eyes on her, up they all jumped, and shouted out every wind of them, "Come and sit by me!" But she said, "No, thank you, no sitting. I am bound for the ocean stream. There is a grand sacrifice in the Ethiopian country for us immortals, and I want to have some too. But Achilles is praying to North Wind and West Wind. He wants them to come and promises a good sacrifice. He wants them to make the pyre burn where Patroclus lies with the people all mourning around." Her message given, away she flew. And the winds rose with a devil of a noise and drove the clouds in a riot before them. They swooped upon the sea and raised the billows under the whistling blasts. They reached the Trojan coast and fell on the pyre till the flames roared again. All night long they beat upon the fire together, blowing and whistling. All night long stood Achilles holding his goblet and dipped into the golden mixer, and poured the wine on the ground till the place was soaked, calling upon the soul of unhappy Patroclus. As a father laments while he burns the bones of his own son, newly wedded and now dead to the grief of his bereaved parents, so Achilles lamented as he burnt the bones of Patroclus, stumbling up and down beside the pyre with sobbings and groanings. But at the time when the morning star goes forth to tell that light is coming over the earth, and after him the saffron mantle of dawn spreads over the sea, at that hour the flame died down and the burning faded away. Then the winds returned over the Thracian Gulf to their home, while the waters rose and roared. And then Achilles moved away from the pyre and sank upon the ground, tired out. Sleep leapt upon him and gave him peace. Now the people were all gathering round Agamemnon. They made such noise and uproar that Achilles sat up and said, "Atrides, and you other princes, you must first quench the pyre with wine wherever the flames have touched. Then let us gather the bones of Patroclus Menetides, and be careful to find the right ones. They are easy to know, for he lay right in the middle, and the others were on the edge, horses and men together. His bones we must wrap in a double layer of fat, and lay them in a golden urn, until I myself shall be hidden in Hades. But I do not wish any great mound to be raised for him, only just a decent one. Afterwards, another can be raised, both broad and high, by those of you who are left behind me." They did his bidding at once. First they quenched the pyre with wine, wherever it had burnt and the ashes were deep. Then, weeping, they gathered the bones of their gentle companion and laid them covered with fat in a golden urn, which they wrapped up in fine linen and put away safely in the hut. Round the pyre they set up a circle of stone slabs to mark the outside limit, and shoveled earth within. As they were about to go after finishing this task, Achilles told them to stop, and made them sit in a ring while he sent back for prizes, cauldrons and tripods, horses and mules and fine cattle, women also, and grey steel. For the chariot race, he offered as first prize a woman skilled in women's work and a tripod of 22 measures with handles to it. The second prize was a mare, a 6-year-old, unbroken, heavy, with a mule foal. The third was a cauldron of 4 measures, brand new and still white, the fourth 2 ingots of gold, and the fifth a brand new basin with handles. Then he rose to his feet and addressed them. "My lord king, and gentlemen all, here are prizes ready for the charioteers. If our contests were held in honor of any other, I should be sure of carrying home the first prize, since you know how much the best my horses are, for they are immortal. Poseidon himself gave them to Peleus, my father, and he lent them to me. But let me say that I and my horses will not come forward. Think of the glorious driver they have lost, how kind he was. How often he would wash their manes in pure water and pour soft oil upon them. And now they stand, trailing their manes in the dust and mourning him. Now they stand with sorrow in their hearts. The course is open to all the rest of you, whoever believes in his horses and car." The competitors quickly came up, and first, by a long way, Eumelos, Admetos' son, who was well known for horsemanship. Next came Diomedes Tydides, driving the two horses of Tros which he had taken from Aeneas when Apollo saved the man. Next, King Menelaus Atrides, with a pair of quick goers, Agamemnon's mare, Sunshine Aethe, and his own horse, Whitefoot Podargos. Agamemnon's mare was the gift of Echepolus Anchisiades, a very rich man who lived in Sicyon, which he offered because he wanted to stay at home, happy, instead of going to war. The mare was eager for the race. Antilochus was the fourth who brought a team. This was the son of Nestor Neleides, and the horses were Pylos bred. As he was getting ready, Nestor took the opportunity to give him some advice, although he was quite able to do without it. And this is what he said. "Zeus and Poseidon were very kind to you, Antilochus, when you were quite young, and they taught you all the art of horsemanship. Then I don't think there is much need to teach you anything, for you know well how to wheel round the post. But your horses are the slowest of all, and so I fear you will find it a bad job." "Their horses are faster, true, but the men could not be more knowing than you are." "Well then, dear boy, rub up every trick you can think of, or the prizes will give you the slip and out of sight." "The tricks of the trade and a woodman's maid. He does not depend on brute force. The tricks of the trade and a pilot's maid. The winds may blow, but on he'll go. And the tricks of the trade make driver beat driver. One man leaves everything to horses and car, wheels wide to this side or that side carelessly. The horses go roaming over the course. He does not hold them in hand. But he that knows his tricks may have inferior horses to drive, yet he keeps his eye always on the post. Wheels close in, does not forget how much to stretch the horses at first by the handling of the reins, but keeps them well in hand and watches the man in front. Now, I will tell you the mark. You can't miss it. There's a dry stump at the turn of the road, standing about a fathom above the soil. Oak or fir, which does not rot in the rain. Two white stones are set against it, one on each side, and the land round this is smooth for horses. It may be the mark of some man dead long ago, or set up for a post in former days. And now Achilles has fixed it for the turning point of his race. Drive your car close, almost grazing the post, and yourself in the basket lean gently to the left. Give the goad to the off-horse with a call, and let him have rein. Let the near horse almost graze the post, so that the nave of the wheel seems almost to touch the surface of the stone. But do not let it touch, or you may wreck the car and damage the horses. That will be a disgrace to you and a pleasure to the others. But, my dear boy, keep your head and be careful. For if at the turning post you can cut in and get round in front, no man alive could catch you by a spurt or pass you, even if he were driving Arion, Adrastos' divine thoroughbred racer, or some of Laomedon's fine stock from this part of the world. Then Nestor returned to his seat, after telling his son all the ins and outs of the matter. Meriones was the fifth. When they were all ready, they mounted their cars and threw in their lots. Achilles shook them, and the lot of Antilochus leapt out. Next came Eumelos, after him Menelaus Atrides, then Meriones, and last, the best of them all, got his place, Tydides. They took stand in a row, and Achilles showed them the turning point in the distant plain. He posted his father's man Phoenix as umpire to keep an eye on the running and report what happened. They were all off together at once, whipping up the horses, flicking them with the reins, crying them on furiously. The ships were left behind, and away they galloped. Their manes went flying on the wind, and clouds of dust rose under their bodies. The cars now ran steady, now bounded high. The drivers stood in their baskets with hearts beating high in hope. Every man called to his horses, and the horses flew over the ground.
But when they had turned back seawards on the return course, then indeed each horse showed his mettle. Then indeed they forced the pace. At once Eumelos' mares took the lead, followed by the stallions of Diomedes, the famous breed of Tros. Not far behind, indeed quite close. They seemed ever on the point of trampling on Eumelos' car, and their breath warmed his back and shoulders as their heads leaned over his body. And now Diomedes would have passed, or at least made a dead heat, if Apollo had not been annoyed at his success. So he knocked the whip out of his hand. Tears of anger filled his eyes as he saw the mares going better than ever, and his own team slackening without the prick. But Apollo's cheating did not escape the eye of Athena. She picked up the whip and gave it back, encouraged the horses, ran after Eumelos furious, and broke the yoke of his chariot. His horses ran away off the road, and the pole was left dragging on the ground. The driver was rolled out over the wheel and barked his elbows and mouth and nose and bruised his forehead. Tears filled his eyes. He choked and could not utter a word. Tydides kept his team in hand and cleared them, galloping now far in front of the others, for Athena put spirit into the horses and made him win. After him came Menelaus. But Antilochus, who was next, shouted to his pair, "Go it, you two! Pull away! There's no time to waste! I don't ask you to beat that pair in front. Athena has made them go like that, and she will make him win. But do catch up Atrides. Don't let his horses beat you. What a shame! Let a mare beat a pair of stallions? Why are you behind, my brave boys? I tell you plainly, and I shan't forget, there will be no more fodder for you in Nestor's stable. He'll just cut your throats at once if we make poor sport by carelessness. After him! Put on a spurt! I know what to do. I'll head past him at the narrow way. He shan't escape me." They were fairly terrified by their master's shouts, and put on a spurt for a short time, until Antilochus saw the narrows. The road here led through a gully, and in one part the winter flood had broken down part of the road and made a hollow. Menelaus was driving in the middle of the road, hoping that no one would try to pass too close to his wheel. But Antilochus turned his horses out of the track and followed a little to one side. This frightened Menelaus, and he shouted at him, "What reckless driving, Antilochus! Hold in your horses! This place is narrow! Soon you will have more room to pass. You'll foul my car and destroy us both!" But Antilochus only plied the whip and drove faster than ever, as if he did not hear. They raced about as far as the cast of a quoit swung from the shoulder of a lusty young man who tries what he can do, and then Atrides fell behind. He let the horses go slow himself, for he was afraid they might all collide in that narrow space and overturn the cars and fall in a struggling heap. But he shouted angrily, "That was a nasty trick, Antilochus! Damn you! Why do we say that Antilochus always plays the game? Far from it! Still, you shan't get your prize without taking your oath." Then he called to the horses, "Now then, don't be slack, don't stand still there. It's hard on you, of course, but you'll see their feet and joints will fail before yours. Their young days are behind them." The horses took the hint and put on pace until they caught up the others. Meanwhile, the crowd was looking out for the horses. Soon they came flying along in clouds of dust. Idomeneus, the Cretan prince, was the first to see them. He was sitting away from the rest on high ground. He heard a shout and knew the man's voice. Then he made out a horse clear in front. He was roan, so far as he could see, with a white full moon on his forehead. He stood up and shouted to the spectators, "Hello, my lords and gentlemen! I spy horses. Can you see them, too? Another team appears to be in front. Looks like another driver. The mares must have come to grief somewhere on the plain, but they were leading on the way out. I certainly saw them first at the turning, but now I can't see them at all. I have looked hard over the whole plain. Did he lose his reins? Couldn't hold them and failed at the turn? That's it. I think he was thrown out and wrecked his car, and the horses ran away at their own sweet will. Do get up and have a look, too. I can't see clearly, but he seems to be that Aetolian prince. You know who. He has the city in Argos. Diomedes Tydides."
Aeus, Oileus' son, laughed scornfully and said, "Cataracts of talk, as usual, Idomeneus. There are the mares yonder, the old high-stepping racers. You are not the youngest man in the army, so much as all that. Those eyes in your head are not so much the sharpest of the whole nation, but always cataracts of words. You really should not be such a cataract orator before your betters. The same mares are leading that led before, and the same Eumelos holding the ribbons.
This brought an angry reply from my dominus. Quarrels are your best line, Ears, for you have not much sense, and for anything else we can all beat you easily. You are a stubborn one. Come along now. Let us bet a tripod or a cauldron which team is first, and the umpire shall be my Lord Agamemnon. You will learn something when you pay up.
Then Aeus the runner jumped up to make a retort with more angry words, and the quarrel would have gone on, but Achilles stopped them by saying, "Don't abuse each other like that, you two, Idomeneus and Aeus. It is quite out of place here. You would be the first to reprove anyone else who did that kind of thing. Sit down in your places and see what happens. They will soon be here themselves, and then everyone will know who is first and who is second."
While he spoke, Tydides had come quite near, at the gallop, plying his whip down from the shoulder, and the horses were bounding along at full speed, kicking up clouds of dust over their driver, and the car, with its gold and tin plates gleaming, rolled behind. The tires left hardly a trace in the light dust, so quickly they flew. And now he was there, in front of them, the sweat dripping from the horses' heads and chests. He leapt down from the car and linked the whip against the yoke. Nor was Sthenelus behindhand. He ran up and took the prize and then loosed the horses. The woman and the tripod were taken in charge by his comrades. Next Antilochus drove in, after beating Menelaus, by trick, not by merit. Even so, Menelaus was close behind, as near as a horse to the wheel when he trundles his master along at full speed. The tip of the tail touches the tire. That is pretty close. There is not much space between. Menelaus had got as near as that, and when he began there was a quoit's throw between them. But Menelaus soon caught up, for Agamemnon's mare Sunshine was in great form, and if the course had been longer she would have passed and left no doubt as to the winner. But Meriones was a spear's throw behind Menelaus, for his horses were slowest of all, and he was the worst driver for a race. Eumelos came in last of all, dragging his car behind and driving the horses in front. Achilles was very sorry for him and made no secret of his feelings.
"The best man comes last," he said. "But let us give him a prize, as he deserves. He shall have the second, but Diomedes must have the first."
There was a cheer at this, and he would have given him the mare with general approval, but Antilochus Nestorides pleaded his claim before Achilles Pelides. "Achilles, I shall strongly resent it if you do what you have said, for you intend to rob me of my prize, and your only reason is that his horses and car came to grief, and himself too, though he is such a good man. Well, he ought to have made his prayers to heaven, and then he would never have come in last at all. If you are sorry for him and want to show your friendship, there is plenty in your quarters. There is gold, there is bronze and sheep, there are captive women and horses. Take some of that and give him even a bigger prize by and by, or even now, that everyone may be pleased. But the mare I will not give up. If anyone wants it, let him fight me for it."
Achilles smiled, for Antilochus was his very good friend, and he was delighted with him. He answered,
"Very well, Antilochus, if you say I am to fetch out something more to give Eumelos, I certainly will. He shall have the corselet I took from Asteropaeus, bronze with a slip of tin running round it. That will be a treasure for him."
He directed Automedon to fetch it out from the hut. Automedon did so and handed it to Eumelos, who received it with satisfaction.
And now Menelaus rose in high dudgeon, for he had not forgiven Antilochus. The herald placed the staff in his hand and called for silence, and Menelaus proceeded to speak. "Antilochus," he said, "you were always one for fair play, and now see what you have done. You have disgraced my reputation and fouled my horses by throwing yours in front, when yours were not nearly as good. I appeal to you, my lords and gentlemen, judge between us without favor, that no one may ever say Menelaus compelled Antilochus to give way by false evidence. He leads away the mare because he is superior in dignity and power, although his horses were not nearly so good. Or look here, I will decide the matter myself, and I don't think any man will ever reproach me, for it shall be justice. Come this way, Antilochus, my young prince, and observe the custom. Stand before your chariot and horses, and take in your hand the whip that you had in the race. Lay your hand on the horses, and swear by Earth-Holder Earth-Shaker that you did not foul my chariot with malice aforethought.
Antilochus, once more the man of fair play, made answer. Bear with me now, for I am much younger than you, my lord Menelaus. You are my elder and my better. You know that a young man always goes too far. His mind is too hasty, his wits are flighty. Then let your heart forgive me. I will give up to you willingly the horse I want. And if you demand something of my own, besides something greater, I will give it at once, rather than be out of favor with you, my prince, all my days, and offend against heaven besides. Then he led up the mare and gave her over to Menelaus. And the prince's heart was warmed, like growing corn with the dew upon the ears when the fields are bristling.